Thank you for listening to Psychedelic Parenting, a service of Awakening Families. If you like what you hear, consider a tax-deductible gift to this work through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, or use one of our Amazon links when you're buying the things you need.
Want to share with their young people the grandeur and the glory that they are encountering.
What's really important is the felt presence of direct experience. We have to stop consuming our culture. We have to create culture. Create your own roadshow. Nexus of space and time, where you are now, is the most immediate sector of your universe.
Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. This is the 33rd episode of the podcast, a very auspicious number, and it comes to you on an auspicious date, April 19th, or Bicycle Day, which commemorates the anniversary of Albert Hofmann's first deliberate experiments with LSD on April 19th, 1943. As the effects began to come on, Hofmann left his office and rode his bicycle home. The holiday was invented in the 1980s by my fellow Midwesterner, Dr. Tom Roberts. Today is also the beginning of the 2017 MAPS Psychedelic Science Conference in Oakland, California. I would love to be there with all my dear friends, but finances have prevented me from attending. I wish all in attendance the best of times, and I commend them for their efforts to change the public perception of psychedelics in America and worldwide. If you're interested in being a part of what's happening long distance, please join me in watching the live stream from the symposia stage in the marketplace area of the event. You can find links to the stream in the program notes of this podcast or by going to symposia.com. I would also like to formally announce a couple of upcoming events that we at Michael Meditations are putting on in Jamaica and invite you all to join us. First, we still have slots available for our next retreat, May 17th through the 24th. I will be rejoining my soul brothers, Omar and Eric, in Jamaica for the June 14th through 22nd Psychedelic Families Retreat. I will be giving a talk on reclaiming religious freedom and family values, and we invite you to bring your loved ones for a chance to experience deep bonding and healing on the shores of Treasure Beach, facilitated by us and potentated by the mushrooms themselves. Finally, we would also like to announce our very exciting upcoming Psychedelic Specialists Retreat. This event will feature four mushroom experiences facilitated by Omar, Eric, and myself, as well as humor by the hilarious Shane Moss, who will be just coming off his multi-city psychedelic-themed A Good Trip comedy tour, and an in-person presentation by my dear friend, former guest, and the director of the NYC Psychedelic Education and Continuing Care Program, Dr. Catherine McLean. This will be an event not to be missed and is limited to only 20 participants. Information about all these events can be found at www.mycomeditations.com. That's MycoMeditations.com. Finally, without further ado, I would like to introduce today's podcast guest and my dear friend, Lex Pelger. Lex is one of the founding members of the Symposia Group, who are going to be doing an event, a comedy stage at Psychedelic Science 2017, coming up in April in Oakland, California. And tied in with that, Lex is going to be going on tour and taking their now world-famous psychedelic storytelling event to what they're calling the Blue Dot Tour, taking it to liberal cities across America in red states. So we're very excited to see what this brings. And Lex is also an author, a writer, and has recently released a very interesting book on cannabis. So we're very happy to have Lex on today. How are you doing, Lex?
Pretty good. Thanks so much, Jonathan. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about your Blue Dot Tour.
The Blue Dot Tour really sprang out of the opportunity that MAPS gave us at the Psychedelic Science Conference in Oakland this April. And because they offered us this great stage where we can put up lots of different people. And then not just comedy. We have speakers from that are academics and underground, and people are just telling stories, and then conversations from people all over the board. And so it's really going to be a fun mix of different types of wisdom and knowledge out there. And because they gave us that chance, and we have to get out there, I decided to take my grandfather's truck and cart it all around the country and do a tour of our storytelling events, of just putting a naked microphone in the middle of the stage and asking the local community to tell their drug stories.
Right on. And so how many stops do you have on this tour?
At this point, we have it laid out as far as Oakland and San Diego and L.A. Uh-huh. And so we have a nice number of stops in between here and there, Boston and Philadelphia and Baltimore, of course. But we're also going to go to my parents' house in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is the one I think nobody can miss. It's beautiful. But then into some of the more smaller places like Athens, Georgia, and Austin, Texas, and Boulder, Colorado, which really epitomize that blue dot in a red state kind of area. But we're looking to go anywhere, and we still have to line up the trip from North Oakland up into the Pacific Northwest, and then coming back down across the country into Florida, and then back up in the Northeast. So we're always looking for new hosts and places to go, and we'll go to red cities and blue states, and purple cities and green states, and orange cities and black states, and anywhere between Mexico and Canada we can find a host.
Exciting. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah, it might be. You know, I've been on the road long enough that I know how hard it is to just be out there plugging away with barely a break in between cities, but it's part of the fun. And The fascinating part to me is I've been a drug writer for about 10 years now, so I've been just collecting people's drug stories forever, it feels like. Uh-huh. And every one of these storytelling sessions, someone tells me something brand new that I had never heard before. And the funniest part about it is most of the time when someone talks about this brand new way to get high, it's, and of course somebody got twisted in that kind of way and it went this way. I just never put it together before that it could. And it speaks to something very basic about how common these are. And the beauty of these storytelling sessions is how much people really educate each other. It's a lot less of the choir preaching the choir about the facts. It's more the anecdotes where you really learn about from someone else's hard trip or their very beautiful experience or their very strange experience. And I think it's very, very educational as much as it is a community builder and as much as it is almost a spiritual experience, especially in places where it can be hard to find the others.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the kind of thing that is going to be really exciting for people because this is always anytime you have one, like a conference or a small event, or you bring in a speaker who is talking about psychedelics, it's always an opportunity to like find out that there's really interesting people that live like in your neighborhood or around the corner that you didn't even know were into psychedelics. So this is going to be a really good opportunity for those folks to have those kind of experiences.
Amen. Exactly. And that's something Symposia always wants to help out on. If somebody is having a conference about psychoactives or some kind of gathering in their community, we would be happy to come. If we can afford it and we can get there to help set up a storytelling session as the thing you do at the end of the night, once people have spent all day listening to other people talk, they are so ready to share their own stories. And it can be really beautiful to see the dynamic and the vibe that comes out of a night like that.
Yeah, and it always seems like it's the really great thing is that it's kind of like this after party thing, and it also kind of it's like open to whoever. And so it kind of breaks down beyond the academic kind of crowd that tends to gather around these things. And it's just kind of like real people.
Exactly.
So tell us about your book.
The Moby Dick of Pot Books.
Yes.
I started researching this book about almost 5 years ago now, I guess. And that's a little bit of the hubris that I'm going to go into as I start go back and begin at the beginning of the story with my first chapter, because my idea was, well, I'll write a book about pot. How long could it take? Get it done in 6 months and then I'll have it done and I'll have a book. And in this day and age, you got to have your book. Where's your book? Where's your book? Mm-hmm. And that was, 4.5 years ago, and I didn't know anything about cannabis. I thought I was some hotshot drug writer with a good focus on the science, and I didn't know that humans had an endogenous cannabinoid system. I didn't know so much of why the biochemistry was there to explain why weed could be such an incredible medicine for aging, but also a way for people to get high in so many different ways, and also a really good way to fuck people up. I think it's sorry, I don't know about your policy.
It's totally good. It's totally good.
Yeah, it's parenting. You gotta swear in front of your kids a little bit.
Yeah.
And also I try to gather all the harms I can find about cannabis, because if I want people to believe when I say that cannabis is almost a miracle drug for all the diseases of aging, it sounds like a crazy statement, which is why I make it. But to make them believe that, I have to capture all the harms that are also there, so it really is a believable piece of science. And so what I'm really trying to do is gather all of the huge, massive data we have from the preclinical literature and all the and the deep science that's been done with all the stories I found out from the road, from teenagers overdoing it and teenagers saving themselves with it and old ladies having miracle cures and old ladies getting so high off one hit that they pass out and the paramedics have to come. It really is all over the board. You know, with most drugs, you kind of know where it's supposed to go. It might not be quite predictable, but there's a flavor to acid or ketamine or cocaine or whatever else we like. Uh-huh. But with weed, it can always be different. Within the same person, it can be different, not even dependent on all the different strains and the ingestion methods. And it's just such a fascinating drug as far as drugs go. And I think it can be the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. And they both have to be acknowledged.
Yeah. So you call this the Moby Dick of pot books. So tell us about, why don't you tell the listeners about your obsession with Moby Dick? Because I think it's amazing.
Well, to begin, I think everyone should be obsessed with Moby Dick. And I know it's a big daunting book. But once you get into it, it's actually incredibly funny and a page turner and not nearly as daunting as it seems. And if you want to get into it, I recommend listening to the audiobook version by this guy, Frank Miller, because he was a Shakespearean actor who reads it out loud. And it just makes the entire whale roll over you in just 22 hours. And then you've consumed what I honestly believe is the best book ever written on this continent. He was channeling Shakespeare and the old Greeks very much so. But the reason it became so important to me was after 3 years of research on this book, I had more to talk about than I could possibly figure out how to fit into one book. And I read Moby Dick on my last research trip across the country, and I was just enthralled. I couldn't put it down. I'd stay up late and on the road reading it. And I realized the structure of that book was exactly the structure I needed to talk about with the American story of weed specifically. Because Melville was talking about and presaging what the United States was going to become for the next century, with the whaling ships being one of the first great American industries. And that model spread, and that capitalistic colonialism was first seen in the whale ships, and it exactly parallels the war on drugs. It was funded by good Quakers, and ridden by sometimes madmen, sometimes good businessmen, assisted by white mates, some of them good guys, some of them enjoying the killing of the whales, and then all built on the backs of people of color who are doing the hardest, messiest job that some humans have ever performed. And so the parallels between the war on drugs and the villainy that makes up this country that was founded in genocide and then fattened up on slavery and then reached a world power on the backs of immigrants, it rings so true still. But that doesn't really explain why specifically Moby Dick, and that's the deep science part of it that I think is so fascinating, because my great white whale is anandamide. And most people don't know what anandamide is, but when I started this research, I didn't know what the great white whale really was. And so I started reading Moby Dick, and it's this big mysterious symbol that could stand for so much. And so what I was chasing was this molecule anandamide, because it is a neurotransmitter that we found in our brains in 1992 that is a cannabinoid. And not only does this explain why weed works so well, strongly, potently on humans. It also explains why it is such a gigantic medicine, because not only is anandamide in the brain, we have a cannabinoid similar to THC in our own brains. Anandamide's more widespread than serotonin or dopamine or these other sexy neurotransmitters you've heard of. And that's why this needs to be spread. In another generation, this will be on the anandamide will be on the tips of people's tongues like dopamine is right now. But it isn't yet. And it needs to be. Because for the class of receptors, the G protein couple receptors that are very complicated receptors that make up about half of all the drug targets of all the pharmaceuticals that we have, the most widespread GPCR receptor is the CB1 receptor for the cannabinoids, the first one we found. So not only do we have this whale swimming around in the depths of our brain, there's billions of them, and they're everywhere, and they're so important, and they affect all kinds of things at the biochemical level, the transcription of DNA, all of these other neurotransmitter systems that they plug into. You have CB1 receptors all over the top parts of your brain, and then you have CB2 receptors on every single organ in your body that somehow is interacting with your immune system at a very basic level. And what we know about the endocannabinoid system is that it functions as a homeostasis system for the body. And that's what explains why this medicine can be so good, because homeostasis is an excellent spot of balance. And so for so many different diseases, weed won't affect you if you're fine, but if you need healing, it will help adjust your body back into a homeostasis state.
Wow. So why did it take so long to discover this neurotransmitter?
That's a good question. Because it's very slippery. It's a lipid, which is a fat molecule, really. And so those are much harder to find. The story actually went in the exact same pathways with opium and our endorphin receptors, except that morphine in the opium plant is an alkaloid, so it's much easier to find. So we found that, I think, around 1900 or so. And so that morphine was a hook that we could drop into the ocean of our brain and pull up this endorphin system that we didn't know we had that was used to regulate pain. And right. So it was the molecule from the plant that gave us the clue to our own neurochemistry. And the exact same thing happened with THC and cannabis, except THC was much harder to pin down. And it wasn't finally the structure and synthesized until 1964 by Raphael Mashulam's team out of Israel. And so with that THC hook finally discovered, we could drop that into the ocean of our brain and pull up this giant white whale named anandamide in 1992.
Interesting.
And so the field is only that old, 25 yeah. years old. That's pretty young as far as science goes. But it also means that the amount of work that has been done, it took me about 4 years of reading in the primary literature just to get the outlines of how widespread this endocannabinoid system is and how many other different systems it affects. And so as far as drugs go in general, it really speaks to why cannabis and opium are the two oldest plants used by man, probably the most used plants by mankind. And hemp is even more spectacular because not only is it a medicine and an intoxicant, it's also very useful as an industrial product in all kinds of ways. And in fact, the evidence is decent that it might have been the first plant ever cultivated specifically by mankind out of our trash pits. You know, you can never prove what that was, but it was right in there. It was one of the first domesticated plants of all time,
which I've always seen as like, I mean, it's so ironic that we call it weed when it's the oldest domesticated plant on Earth.
Yeah, it just ain't right.
Yeah.
But it does grow like a weed. It was probably in their trash pits of early humans, but then once it got to China, you know, one of the first great kingdoms on Earth, it was there from the very beginning. And it was one of the primary clothing fibers used there. Then it was used for rope. as well. And that was fascinating because rope is very useful in terms of agriculture and carrying food around and things like that, but it also enables warfare. Uh-huh. And so the first crossbows, the first catapults, the first multi-stage rocket was in the 8th century by Chinese warlords, and it was all enabled by hemp rope. Huh. Just like a lot of the wars of, really, from the Peloponnesian War up until like the War of 1812 and a little bit past, those were all with rope of hemp on those naval battles because hemp is such a good rope that it doesn't get stressed by seawater, which is really hard for a fabric to do.
Right. And it's an amazing product. And sails too, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The word canvas actually means, it comes from the word cannabis.
Yeah. It's funny now that like when people think of a canvas, they think of like a big plastic thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's fairly amazing to see how dominant this plant has been throughout human history when I really didn't know it going into it. Uh-huh. And it's in each of these different fields as a religious tool, as a way to get high, as a way to heal people, and as an industrial item for a very widespread number of uses.
Yeah, this interesting thing that you're talking about, this idea of like the THC being like a hook to discover this system that it interacts with. My understanding is that LSD has kind of the same relationship with like the serotonin system. Is that correct?
I wouldn't know to speak to that.
Okay.
I think serotonin was discovered before the structure of psychedelics, before tryptamines. Okay. Yeah, but I'm not sure. How acid is, or these tryptamines are still working on the brain is still an unsolved problem. Uh-huh. One more thing where, you know, lazy drug writers like to say, oh, well, it works like this. But any neurochemist worth their salt looks at it and says, we barely looked at it.
Right. And any of these things, like we can talk about, oh, this is what's happening in the brain, or this is what's happening at these receptor sites. But it doesn't really tell us very much about consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, and that's the enigma. That's the like, the thing is, when it will science be able to penetrate consciousness? Because I don't want to sort of speak to like the God of the gaps or something that, oh, you know, we haven't figured this out, so we won't figure it out. But I think that there's that window between like your this substance has an effect on your brain, which has an effect on your consciousness. But where is consciousness? Where is the self? And I think that's a question that is going to be pretty difficult to answer.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's kind of one maybe in a century we'll have a better idea, but it is not a problem I believe we're close to solving.
Uh-huh.
If it can be solved. If we want to solve it.
Right.
Let's leave a little bit of mystery in the world.
A little bit, yeah, right.
But it'll always be there. I mean, that's one of the things that's great about writing a very sciencey book is you get to talk to these scientists, and to any good scientist, they, for all the answers they get to discover and learn during their lifetime, they still will die with more questions than they started with. Because every time you answer something new, it also reveals at least one, usually half a dozen other things that now you have to figure out how and why that works.
Right.
Yeah, it's a little intoxicating, really.
Tell me, how did you use Moby Dick as a framework for your book?
Post-it notes, mostly. A whole wall. You've seen my house.
I've seen the wall of post-it notes, yeah.
The wall of post-it notes. I wrote every chapter from Moby Dick and the best things that happen in it on the wall in three sections. And then I started thinking about weed and going through my books and seeing how that lined up. And it really lined up nicely. The first third of the book will be the American story with weed from the golden age of medical cannabis right after the Civil War up until around Barack Obama's election. Uh-huh. And then it's going to go back to the very beginning with the evolution of the endocannabinoid system, because anything with a spinal column on this earth has an endocannabinoid system. That's how basic this system is to life. Uh-huh. And so I'm going to go back there and then through the cannabinoid system that developed in the plant much later than the endocannabinoid system. and then take it through human history, because every great empire has some kind of story with cannabis, from the Chinese to the Persians to the Arabs. Everybody somehow gets involved, and I'll bring it all the way back up until the Golden Age and the Civil War again at the second third of the book, and then I'm going to dive into the neurochemistry. And so if this really does go like I want to, there's 135 chapters in Moby Dick, and I have two full volumes written so far, so I just have 133 chapters to go before I lay out what needs to be said about cannabis scientifically.
And how can people get access to this?
If you go to lexpelger.com, it has more. There's some teasers there that you can see. And if you go to Symposia, you can buy my books on our bookstore there. But if you really wanted it to be helpful, I have a Patreon account as well. So that's monthly support. And so if you wanted to sign up to donate a certain amount per month, like $12 per month for the Starbuck level or $22 per month for the Queequeg level, who is the Jesus of Moby Dick, if you're looking for character analysis, I will send you one of these printed editions, and I'll fill it up with whale stamps and inscriptions for you as a thank you for monthly support to keep doing this work.
Right on. So that's an interesting thing that I think that many people are not aware of, is the fact that Starbucks coffee is named after a character in Moby Dick.
That's true. Yeah. The good follower. The one. Yeah. There's actually, and the C.L.R. James, the great socialist thinker, about 100 years ago, his idea was the entire thing of Moby Dick was the crew not killing Captain Ahab is truly the fault of this nation. That's what's wrong with America, is that we're not overthrowing this rotten system and try to make something more equitable for everybody.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which I don't think we'll ever do. It's a nice thing to talk about, but.
So if what do you think is the best film adaptation of Moby Dick?
I really like the Gregory Peck edition. Uh-huh. Especially because it's directed by John Huston. And if you like Ray Bradbury, uh-huh, he wrote the script for that version of Moby Dick. And then he wrote a book about working with John Huston in Ireland to make this movie happen. And John Huston was a madman. He was a Captain Ahab figure. So to have like the sweetheart Ray Bradbury talking about the Irish people that he loves and the crazy captain of this movie, it's an incredible piece. It's a wonderful work. Yeah.
Huh, right on. So one of the things that I've always found interesting about you is that even though you don't have any children, you have kind of a sweet spot for kids' books. And so I was hoping you might recommend a couple of children's books to our listeners.
Yeah, sure. Because I collect them because I honestly do think they're some of the pinnacles of human creation. If you can make something that looks breathtakingly beautiful, uh-huh, with a message and a story that can be understood by a five-year-old, it's an incredibly hard thing to do. I think it's poetry combined with art. Uh-huh. And the number one I would ever recommend, I usually tell people to just buy six copies of this book called The Three Questions by this guy, John Muth, because it's actually Tolstoy's short story, The Three Questions. But this author reimagined it with instead of three friends, it being Sonia the heron and the dog and his friends, where he asks what matters in this life. Uh-huh. And throughout that story, you get the answer to that question, just as Leo Tolstoy originally put it down. So to have a beautifully illustrated version of what Tolstoy thinks matters the most in life, it's a superb work of creation.
Right.
In fact, that guy, John Muth, has a couple other things where he takes old Zen stories and things like that and reinterprets them with a giant panda bear telling the stories. And it's just a great way to get some of that old wisdom stuff. In fact, one for a little bit older is Rabbi Harvey. It's a very simple comic book style book, but it's all of these old Jewish tales by this rabbi in the Wild Wild West gets into. So it's really a chance for the author to tell old Shalom Aleichem stories in the Wild Wild West. It's really great. And the last one I'll recommend that I think is really great because I have a young niece who's a firebrand, and I'm always collecting great books for smart young girls. Uh-huh. And Rosie Revere, the Engineer, is a beautiful book about a girl whose aunt is Rosie the Riveter.
Uh-huh.
And so then she becomes, from her aunt's encouragement, she becomes her own little maker. And it's a really well done book.
Oh, neat. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Right on. So we will include links to our Amazon page so that if any bit of our listeners are interested in getting some of Lex's recommendations, you can do so through there. And by clicking on that link and ordering the book, you'll also be supporting Psychedelic Parenting. So thanks for those recommendations, Lex.
Nice.
So I guess I want to also like to have you chime in on the question of, in regards to cannabis, how old is old enough when it comes to young people?
Wow. Great. You don't throw the softballs.
No.
No. It is one of the most haunting questions, I believe, about all of this. And not just cannabis, though it's a particularly interesting one, but you know, to see places like South America where ayahuasca use from the cradle on up is pretty standardized and accepted into society. And then you go to Europe, and drinking wine from a very young age is an accepted part of society in moderation. And it's interesting to see how these drug experiences can be weaved in when the culture supports a healthy take on it, which is not this culture. If you live here in the United States, it has always been a culture of big, heavy takers of drugs. Every visitor here from Alexei de Tocqueville onward has always said these brash young Americans, they drink and they smoke and they just take huge amounts of drugs.
Yeah.
It, for whatever reason, it's part of this manifest destiny that is this country. And so it's trickier around here. And it's especially hard because teenagers and cannabis is a difficult question. We give these kids so many powerful drugs like Valium and Adderall, which is, you know, just a depressant and a speed.
Right.
And cannabis for treating the kind of things those often treat can be much better, especially high CBD cannabis.
Uh-huh.
But as Paracelsus onward said, the dosage makes the drug. And so for teenagers to be dabbing huge amounts of cannabinoids, and dabbing is the butane hash oil, usually out of Colorado and California. It's really become an interesting way for people to take in tons of pot.
Yeah.
And the clean part about dabbing is that you have no other plant material. It is simply cannabinoids going into your system. Uh-huh. So if this is an older person with severe back pain, it can be one of the safest, cleanest ways to imbibe cannabis to help your painkillers work better.
Uh-huh.
And it's often something used by soldiers with PTSD because it's a nice, clear way to calm down their PTSD reactions to situations. And it takes huge amounts of dabs to just keep them at a nice baseline.
Uh-huh.
But on the flip side, for teenagers to be doing those huge levels, it's clearly not good.
Uh-huh.
And this is one thing I get a ton of pushback about, but I like being a bit of a devil's advocate.
Yeah.
And the studies are clear that doing huge amounts of weed as a teenager isn't great for your long-term outcome. It's obviously not going to kill you. But if your brain especially is susceptible to worse outcomes, whatever that might be, there can be more depression, more schizophrenia, more things like that.
Huh.
And so lots of kids will be fine doing these amounts. But these studies were done, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, when people were just smoking regular amounts of weed.
Yeah.
And I think what dabbing is going to do with the teenager's natural impulse to take in tons of stuff is that it's going to push it. It's going to exacerbate those moderate harms we already know from cannabis and make them so much worse.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what we do. I mean, you have people in South America chewing coca, and you know, we make cocaine. We have, you can smoke opium, but we like our heroin and our fentanyl. It's like we like the strongest, most concentrated stuff that we can get our hands on.
Yes. And it's also a consequence of prohibition. It's cheaper and easier and better profit margin to be doing dabs oftentimes.
Right.
You can throw in the fan leaves, you can throw in all this other junk that's too moldy to actually sell, and you concentrate it down to something where it actually can be toxic with all the pesticides and molds in it, but you can't see it.
Right.
So you just smoke it.
Right.
And the other thing worth mentioning about teenagers' brains is that this is just my personal guess from the science, but I think it's a decent guess, is that the second great phase of brain development in humans is the adolescent years, and it's not actually the brain developing. It's called synaptic pruning. And so all of the connections that your brain has made in those first 12 or 14 years of life as you explore the universe, what makes your brain into a nice sculpted piece of bonsai with all the connections flowing to the right place is the teenage years, where your brain trims massive amounts of those connections.
Interesting.
The number of neurons stays about the same, but the connections get trimmed down massively. And it seems like for people with schizophrenia specifically, they have a miswiring in that age. That's why schizophrenia often comes out in the teenage years, is because your brain doesn't trim down those connections. Maybe not because those brains don't trim down the connections, but in schizophrenic brains, they are often not trimmed down. And because weed is so protective of the brain, and I mean so protective, if you have any relative with Parkinson's, ALS, MS, any kind of neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's as well, you need to be getting CBD into their system. It is foolhardy not to be taking that medicine as an adjunct to all your other medicines. But for teenagers to be protecting the brain, it might be that the weed is protecting those synapses that need to be cut off.
Interesting.
And it's not letting your brain burn enough. And it's why there is that small, moderate link between heavy use of cannabis and schizophrenia.
That's a really good answer, and it's not an argument that I have heard before, and I think it's pretty convincing. That's good.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of an explanation of the science, but it's not an actual answer to how to do it in our society. I mean, I think absolutely no kids should be going to prison or any kind of severe punishment that screws them up for the rest of their lives for doing these drugs.
Right.
On the flip side, for the government to be allowing kids over the age of 12 to be taking these drugs, I don't think that's the right answer. I would think that at 18 you can buy pot would be a reasonable limit, and that would keep it out of the hands of more kids. But if you do really want to work and get it because you just absolutely need it, then that is more up to your parents about how that's supposed to go. And the hard part with weed is it's an incredible medicine. And there's all kinds of kids with epilepsy and anxiety and Crohn's disease and all this whole swath of diseases that they do need medical cannabis.
Yeah.
And sometimes they need huge doses of it. And it's going to be a tricky thing for society to decide how this is going to work.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. How can people find out more about the Blue Dot Tour?
If you want to know more about the Blue Dot Tour, you can go to the Symposia website, and we have it there on our events page. And Symposia is spelled P-S-Y-M-P-O-S-I-A. And it's like the old style symposias of the Greek world, where you sit around, you drink, you talk, you figure some stuff out, you bullshit a little bit. That's kind of what the vibe we're going for, right, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good, an accurate description of these events.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I didn't mention in the introduction that I would love to tell our listeners about if we're allowed to, and if we're not, we'll just edit this out, that you are going to be the new host of the Psychedelic Salon.
Almost. I'm not going to be the new host as much as we will be the first ones contributing to the Psychedelic Salon 2.0.
Uh-huh.
And I think Lorenzo is glad to have some help to get another version of this started and to start taking in more content from the community.
Right on.
So, yeah, we get to be his first helpers. And I'll be hosting some of the first contributed episodes to the Psychedelic Salon 2.0. And yeah, it's a really big honor to hear that from someone like Lorenzo.
Mm-hmm.
It's also rather intimidating because he leaves such big shoes to fill.
Indeed.
I'm always asking people, why do you like Lorenzo so much? Like, what's good about him as a podcaster? Just so I can learn to be better myself. And the word they use for him is that he is authentic.
Yes, I would definitely say that.
Yeah, and it's a great word. It's easy to be polished, and it's easy to be very smart and let everyone know you know everything. But to truly be there like he does, it's a really beautiful thing to pull off. And so we're really honored to have someone like him ask us to help, you know, feature more voices of storytellers, of some underground wisdom people, of authors, of whoever we think that the community would like to hear more about. We're hoping to get on the show.
Right on. And
including yourself, by the way.
Right on. No, I'll be happy to be a part of that. The Psychedelic Salon was the first podcast on psychedelics that I ever listened to, and Lorenzo was actually Josh Wickerham's first webmaster when he started like publishing on the internet back in the very late 90s. So it's definitely the seed that sowed Terrence McKenna into our brains.
Wow, yeah. That's great. He yeah. digs deep, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah, definitely. So I would actually really love to interview Lorenzo on here. That would be really interesting to hear about how he raised his kids. I know that he came to psychedelics a bit later in his life, but I'm sure he's got some really interesting stories about his family relationships and things.
Yeah, I bet. I bet he does.
So what else would you like to our listeners to know about your book or about Symposia or about what's happening at Psychedelic Science?
I think what I'd like to tell them is if they get a chance to come to Oakland for Psychedelic Science, I really think you should. Uh-huh. The tickets will probably be sold out by the time anybody hears this, but we'll be in the marketplace, which is free and open to the public, and it's going to be jam-packed with the tea house and the MAPS bookstore and a bunch of art and vendors selling pretty things. And we'll also have our stage there featuring all kinds of speakers from all kinds of walks of life. And it's really going to be a great spot to bring someone who might be curious about this kind of world. There'll be all kinds of different flavors of people there and all kinds of different types of education. And so it's amazing to see what MAPS is bringing together with this. Yeah. It is a huge operation that they have going, and we really appreciate the chance to feature some of the voices that might not get heard as much.
Yeah. So do you have any specific people that you could mention that will be appearing on the Symposia stage?
Sure. One I'm really excited for, Austin Hill Shaw is doing one about honoring Houston Smith, which I'm really looking forward to. I think Houston Smith is just such a great thinker, and if anyone wants to learn about religions, his book on world religions is just so personal and well done and takes the best out of each walk of faith on the planet.
Yeah.
Which I think is great. And then
Houston like Smith was one of the subjects of the Good Friday experiment too.
Yes. Yeah. Wait, he was there?
He was one of the people that took psilocybin at the Good Friday experiment, yeah.
That's right. Oh man. Oh bad. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll also have people like Dr. Gerardo Isaac. He's going to talk about 5-MeO-DMT, mm-hmm. Which he uses as a sacrament. And Jim Fadiman will be talking with John Harrison about Esalen's legacy and the history of psychedelics. Mark Franklin, who has taken beautiful photographs of the psychedelic pioneers. You can look up some of his stuff online. His nephew, Jesse Jarnow, will be narrating about these photographs of the psychedelic pioneers. Oh, Jesse's neat. The guy who wrote that book Heads about the Grateful Dead and the LSD distribution network that came out of that. Which is a great book.
Right on.
Connie Littlefield, who did the Sunshine movie. Uh-huh. She's going to be talking about making that beautiful piece. And our friend Robert J. Barnhart, who will be talking about grace and self-effort in a psychedelic life. That's something worth mentioning. Thanks to Robert, we will be able to show his movie Psilocybin, The Science of Psilocybin, A New Understanding, on our tour as well.
Nice.
And so it'll be a great way to introduce people new to this, because I think we'll often start the movie around 6 o'clock. So people coming can show it to people who might not know anything about psychedelics. And the movie is so good about combining very grounded science with people's stories about why this worked for them. it can be very convincing to people who have only heard lies of the drug wars.
Yeah.
And so, and because it's such story oriented, once we start our storytelling nights at these events, people will be even more ready to open up because they already heard stories from other people.
Yeah.
So really, Robert's movie is going to help break the ice for us. So we really appreciate being able to work with him and show this movie all over the continent.
Right on. Yeah, Robert's going to be on this show here probably in the next couple of weeks. I hope we're trying to figure out a date to get together and record a show. So I'm very excited about that. He's a very dear friend.
Oh, that's great. Yeah he's...
Let's just finish off. I think you've left us with a lot of really great meat to sink our teeth into and a really interesting perspective on cannabis and youth that I don't think I've heard before. And I'm really excited that we got here recorded. One more time, just let everybody know how they can find out more about your book, about Symposia, and about psychedelic science.
Great. Yeah. If you want to go to lexpelger.com, you can see more about my book. I have two finished installments now. The queer chapter is about Ronald Reagan ignoring the AIDS crisis and how that mm-hmm. sparked the modern medical marijuana movement. And yeah. And then we just finished my first really full book. It's a 140-page graphic novel. Thanks to my illustrator. It's really beautiful. And it's on the chemical chase for the cannabinoids. It's actually only volume one of chapter 25 of Moby Dick, which is the shortest chapter. So each paragraph of that Moby Dick chapter is expanded out to a full book. But mine is actually about from the golden age of cannabis. They were hunting for what made cannabis work. And it took until 1940 to get the first structure of a cannabinoid synthesized in 1940. Uh-huh. And so it's really about the chemistry of that as told through elephants and alchemy. Because looking for the cannabinoids is like looking for invisible elephants and trying to study them on distant planets with lousy telescopes. That's the whole conceit right there. It works, I think, or there's too much hash in this house. Either way.
Or both.
And then to find out more about our work, we are Symposia, PSYMPOSIA. And we have a lot of great stuff coming up. The Blue Dot Tour and the conference is our biggest things, but we also have a magazine. And we also collect people's drug stories. If you want to submit a video or a writings of your drug story, we love to feature stuff like that. And I always encourage people, we helped start a campaign with a bunch of other great drug organizations called Psychedelics Because.
Uh-huh. And yeah, that was
great. If people felt like coming out of the psychedelic closet, I think this is a really important time to do it and to just share somewhere that these drugs have mattered to you and share it under the hashtag psychedelics because I think it's one of the most important things for changing hearts and minds. It's why I focus so much on the storytelling because you might deny the data, you might call these studies fake news, but when someone looks in the eye and says, this is how this changed my life.
Right.
You can't call them a liar.
No.
You might think it might not work for you, but you will believe their story. And I think that some of the most important data about these drugs is within us and within our community. And that's why we really want to share that in all the different ways we can.
Yeah. Right. And any listeners that are new to my show, I'm actually one of the people on the Psychedelics Because promotional video. So you can see a little bit about a tiny little snippet of why I think the psychedelics are important to me.
That's great.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Lex. You are definitely one of my dearest friends, and I am so happy to have had you on here and promoting all the exciting things that you're doing.
Hey, man. It's always great to talk to you, Jonathan.
All right, man. Talk to you again soon on the road.
All right. Sounds great.
All right. Bye.
Advice is to learn from your children and perhaps eventually, when you're spiritually ready, you'll turn on with your children if you think that's the right thing to do.
What is real is you and your highs and your friends and your associations.